Hello and welcome to another Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild, Editor-in-Chief of EG. The London Festival of Architecture is drawing to a close. This month-long celebration of the capital as the global hub for architecture has run throughout June, and since its launch in 2004, it's grown to become the world's largest annual architecture festival, attracting a public audience of more than 600,000 people last year. This year's theme has been boundaries. To live in cities is to be surrounded by boundaries. Borders, fences, walls, zones, and city limits, runs the festival blurb. They define us, they put us in our place. I'm pleased to be joined in the EG studio today by Festival Director Tamsy Thompson. Welcome, Tamsy.
Hi, very pleased to be here.
I bet you're exhausted.
Pretty tired, yeah. Looking forward to July right now.
So what's the build-up like? How long do preparations take? Is it a year-round project?
Yes. So at the moment, we're already starting to plan 2020. So we're working on the theme for next year and the theme launch, which will be in September.
And you get a chance to take a breath, sit back and think this is going rather well?
From moment to moment, yes. Yes, particularly at some of our sort of bigger events where you really get an opportunity to experience the reasons why we do it, bringing those people together and exploring or experiencing some kind of exciting space. So we had our pavilion launch. We have a biennial project with Dulwich Picture Gallery, which is a competition for emerging architects. And that launched last week. We had a sort of party of the good and the great, came to admire it, and the press and the feedback has been amazing. So it was that moment where you stood there and looked at it and thought, yeah, this is actually really good.
Spectacularly colourful as well. Perhaps radio doesn't do it justice.
It is, yes. It's a collaboration between an emerging practice, Price Gore, and a designer, Yinka Ilori. And they've really come together on this amazing collaboration, which has been inspired by Nigerian fabrics. So it's very, very bright, very colourful, very sort of strong, bold patterns. It's an entirely wooden structure and it does all sorts of very exciting things with wood. So we really pushed our engineers, who are EHRW, who are very, very patient with us and our unlimitless demands on them and their time.
Okay, well, they get the deserved shout out there. So you said you do take a moment to step back and think why it is that you do all of this. Why is it that the London Festival of Architecture exists?
Well, we've got two sort of purposes, really. The first began in 2004 with the start of the festival. The festival was started by Peter Murray, who also started New London Architecture and a whole range of other things across his career. And he and a number of other people within the industry realized that our collective industry, architecture, property, construction, doesn't have that moment to sort of celebrate what we do. And what we do is pretty impressive in terms of economic value. We bring in over £1.9 billion gross value added to the capital a year, just architecture alone. We have 22,000 people employed in the city in architecture. But we don't have that kind of London Fashion Week where we get to celebrate what we do, talk about what we do, and engage people. So that was the sort of first primary purpose. But also very central to what we do is engaging the public. So we have this amazing city where people come from all over the world to see our architecture and experience it in the sort of obvious tourist attractions like Tate Modern, for example, but also just in the city itself. So we wanted a way of actually bringing Londoners in and then helping them and encouraging them and allowing them to have the space to celebrate what they find unique and special about their city as well.
And it touches an incredible number of people, 600,000 last year. Is that how is that delivered? How is that achieved, that number? There's very many events, 400, I think.
Yeah, 500 and counting. I haven't got the actual final tally yet. But we have we're an open call. So we open in October of every year and people submit their events. So anyone could submit an event and they do that free of charge. It's an online process. Then we have a curation panel of different people from across the industry who will sift through what's probably about 1,000 events to select what actually becomes the program. And what's really nice about that process is you have everything from community groups to developers to architects to some of the major cultural institutions all coming through the same process. There's parity in how everything's treated. And then within that, we have content that we very directly curate ourselves. We work very closely with the Royal Academy. We work very closely with the V&A, with the ROBA, but also with a number of developers and architects. And then we have our focus areas where we go and curate activity. And this year they were London Bridge, Heart of London, so Piccadilly, St James, Leicester Square, the Royal Docks, and then the Square Mile, City of London.
Okay, we're releasing a video any day now, actually, on the Royal Docks to tie in with the attention that it's getting from the festival and many other places as well. But in looking at those, in selecting those four places, do you hope to deliver lasting physical change there as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Royal Docks, actually the first LFA project in the Royal Docks was delivered in 2012. So in my previous role at the RIBA, and that's a continuing relationship. And obviously over that time, it's now 7 years, we've seen significant change, significant growth in audience, much more interest in those areas. What's really nice is when we sort of started, we were doing derelict London tours, and now we're saying, come and look at the amazing stuff that's being built here.
Okay. And how has it gone, the festival? Are you reaching more people than ever, do you think? Is it resonating more than ever?
I think so. We haven't got our final audience figures back, but we're expecting them to be significantly higher than last year, partly because the content is there, partly because we have a much greater number of sort of big events, which obviously bring a bigger audience, bring in a more public audience, and we're doing an increasing number of installations and things out in the public realm. So we have artworks along Piccadilly with Roger Sturck Harbour and the Heart of London Bid. We have a number of installations across the Square Mile with Cheapside Bid and the City of London Corporation. We have our pavilion that I mentioned in Dulwich. We have things in Canary Wharf. So all over the city, there are sort of very direct objects and installations and spaces for people to go in and experience.
Okay, and in reaching 600,000 or more perhaps, people, there can't be many ways in which this sector, the broad built environment sector, reaches so many members of the public, and the sector's reputation often precedes it. It's seen as something that's perhaps more destructive than constructive very often. Is this an event that reaches more members of the public and showcases the built environment to its best effect, more so than any other?
I would say so. One of the things we work really carefully on is in our curation process, making sure that we don't exclude any groups. So one of the ways that we always like to measure our success is that we have people from all sides of the argument criticising us for working with the other side. And as long as they're all doing that, we know that we're holding the centre ground.
I use that measure a lot as well. Yeah.
And it is actually a very useful measure, because what we're trying, we don't necessarily have a position, we're trying to create the tent that people can have that debate in. And obviously as part of that, a sort of individual member of the public has a point of view which is potentially just as interesting and just as valid as the head of a big corporation which is developing however many acres in London.
Okay, and we're here in the City of London, but it would apply to many other parts of London as well. You don't have to scroll very far down the Twitter page to find criticism of the skyline saying it's awful, you know, it's being destroyed, this needs protecting, or that needs protecting. What's your take on the current state of the built environment from an architectural perspective?
I think if you're looking generally, it's never been better. I think we've learned a lot from the lessons of the past. I think there are some amazing examples of how those lessons have been learned and applied. Doesn't mean that we aren't still making mistakes, and there are things that, you know, happen all over the place that if we looked closely we could criticise or critique. But I think broadly, architecture is in really robust health in this city, and that's shown by the economic value that it brings, the number of people, but also how international it is. And one of the things that I think is actually the biggest risk to architecture at the moment and generally our city generally is Brexit, and specifically for architects, whether they'll be able to employ the kind of great wealth of talent that they currently do. About a third of the workforce comes from the EU. And that's not something that you can immediately make up from London schools of architecture or British schools of architecture. So I think that's a big risk. And obviously when those people come across and they work here, they also bring the culture and the language of the place that they came from, which opens up international trade to the city, which is crucially important. So I think at the moment, actually, that's the the big thing that's worrying. It's will the architecture profession have enough protections through any immigration process to continue to employ them?
So London could be a worse looking city as a result of Brexit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, a stark warning there. Just going back to the festival briefly, and that theme around boundaries. There's some bold sentences there. Boundaries define us; they put us in our place, which, you know, negative or positive. And boundaries make us comfortable. Good fences make good neighbours.
Yeah. Well,
talk me through that a little bit. What was your thinking there?
Well, we were very interested in having a theme that had both a kind of societal, metaphysical kind of context that you could explore it in, but also a very physical context.
Sounds like it's contextualised for a Brexit year as well.
A little bit. And obviously when we set the theme, we may have Brexited or not. We didn't know when we set it in September of last year. So it had to be something that addressed that without in any way anticipating what might or might not have happened. So that was very much the case, but also we wanted something that looked at how boundaries are particularly applied in London. And one of the things that really occurred to us before we even had the word was how London has these boundaries or borders within it at different scales. So when you say you're a Londoner, whereabouts are you from? Does that mean you're from within the M25? Does that mean you live in a London borough? Does that mean you actually live quite a long way out but commute and live and work? So there's that where does London start and end conversation, which is obviously relevant for all sorts of reasons, including who has a say in London and who pays for what happens in London. But also one of the trends that we'd really observed at the sort of the next scale down was development areas across London boroughs and what happens when two boroughs collide and that space in between or over the boundary. And you can see in areas like Crystal Palace, where I think it's five local authorities meet, how that's a real struggle. London doesn't have a solution of how it deals with those kind of edge conditions. So we had quite a lot of content, including a really interesting exhibition by Egre West, which is still on in their studio, about what they call fault lines, what happens in those space. Are they an opportunity area? Because you can do things that you might not be able to do within the kind of precious centre of a local authority. Or are they sort of overlooked and abandoned areas? But then we're also interested in sight lines. And you go around anywhere in London and you can see development which has been kind of dictated by the party wall or by the sight line, and how that really affects what you get and what's able to be delivered, and how we could get people to actually look beyond their boundary lines, beyond that red line on the site plan. And then sort of very physically, our offices are just off Tottenham Court Road, which is undergoing this major resurfacing and reprioritization of the traffic. What we noticed very quickly is there's very expensive, beautiful stones being laid down, but it doesn't go all the way up to the building line. It goes up to where the demise of the council ends and the demise of the property owner begins. So you actually have a pavement which halfway down it at some points is this jagged line with much sort of poorer and different quality on the other side. So you can see this very physical boundaries in lots of different ways.
I'm clearly looking up when I walk along Tottenham Court Road. I should be looking down. But boundaries are important. But good fences make good neighbours.
Yes.
Do they?
Well, we're really interested in exploring that. Actually, we had a
have you
of
have you got an, a month on? Have you got an answer to that? Do good fences make good neighbours?
I think the answer is that if you actually don't know where the fence is, that can often cause problems. Because you don't know where the lines of control are. I think in other more public spaces, obviously the fence can become a barrier. But in understanding particularly your own personal space, sometimes those can be important in defining the kind of the limits of your control.
Okay, and the theme of this podcast is the future of real estate. You said that you're already looking at 2020. Is there anything in mind, or have those ideas yet to crystallise?
They're crystallising, I think it's fair to say. Obviously, we still have the looming Brexit question and what that might mean by next summer, and what that particularly means to our industry, both architecture and then more broadly property and construction. So that's something that has to play into it. Obviously, we're extremely mindful of the ongoing and increasingly heated conversation around sustainability and the role that buildings and city makers have in contributing or not contributing to solutions in that. So I think that's going to have to play in some way.
And does it feel like the architectural sector has answers to some of those very difficult questions in terms of the contribution that buildings make to carbon emissions?
I think they've got answers in a very particular way. So how their building, their particular building that they're working on, might mitigate in some way or might do less harm than it would otherwise. I think generally as an industry, we've got an enormous problem that actually the best thing is to look after what you've got, maintain and renovate and retrofit what's there. And we're geared at the moment, particularly with tax and how we fund and finance things, that it's often easier to knock it down and rebuild it than it is to do that. So I think there's issues around that. But I think what we haven't got to grips with at all as a city, and an industry as part of that city, is the kind of wider issues about where are we really going? What do we really want? Because if we're actually going to get anywhere close to where we need to be in terms of targets, then we have to have some quite radical thinking. And I think that radical thinking definitely isn't there yet.
Okay, where would you expect it to come from?
I think that we've waited a long time for it to come from legislators. So I think it needs to come from the public and us. You know, the industry is part of that public, because we're all individuals, and if we want us and our children and our society to survive, then I think we actually have to face up to what that means to us personally and as individual companies and organisations.
Okay, well, that sounds like an optimistic note to end on. Almost a theme of taking back control there, but I will only use
make
that.
Make architecture great again.
Exactly. There we go. For the sake of the future of real estate, we should make architecture great again. Tamsi, thank you very much for coming in today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.